Welcome to the Bicast, a podcast for the bisexual community. I'm Lynette, and Joan and I are joined today by our guest, Julia Serrano, writer, performer, speaker, and activist, and the author of Whipping Girl, A Transsexual Woman on Sexism and the Scapegoating of Femininity, and Excluded, Making Feminist and Queer Movements More Inclusive. Welcome, Julia. We're really happy to have you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
First, I would like to tell our listeners, if you have not read these two books, you absolutely must. It is required reading. They will clear up any confusion you might have on being trans, what cis really means, feminism for all, and so much more. Julia, tell us a little bit about yourself. Dr. Serrano is a biologist who works as a researcher at UC Berkeley in the field of evolutionary and developmental biology. She received her doctorate in biochemistry and molecular biophysics from Columbia University. And among your discoveries is a K10 transport localization element, TLS, in, I'm not going to get this right, but Destrophilia melanogaster, or commonly known in the U.S. as the fruit fly. How do you find time to do anything?
Well, actually, for a long time, it was very hard to actually. Fairly recently, about 2 years ago, my position at UC Berkeley ended just because the grant that was funding me ended. So since then, I've been mostly writing and doing speaking engagements. So I have a lot more time now than I used to.
That's good, because you needed a little more. So you live in the Oakland area right now, is that correct?
Yeah, I've lived out here for about 20 years, mostly in Oakland, for a short period of time in Berkeley.
Ah, awesome. Nice area.
Yeah, expensive, but nice.
Yeah.
And by the way, if you hear, you might hear my cat. She's making an appearance. She's wanting attention, so.
It's completely okay. We usually have a dog barking. It's kind of like part of the show now, so do not worry about that.
Okay.
She's just she's a guest.
Yeah, why does the cat always jump on the computer? They're looking for mice. So yeah, tell us about some of your work in biology first.
Sure, yeah. So my background was mostly genetics and developmental biology, which is trying to understand how, you know, all animals start out as one cell and then they divide and they create specialized cell types like skin cells and muscle cells and heart cells and so on. And so developmental biology is about trying to understand what changes take place over the course of development to give rise to an animal. So for many years, I studied fruit flies, how their eggs and embryos develop. And then more recently, I was working in a lab that mostly studied a particular type of crustacean, a very small crustacean called parhyale. And we were interested in comparing and contrasting between how crustacean embryos develop versus how insect embryos develop. So that was the very esoteric thing that I did for many years for a living.
Important work.
And, you know, and it comes back in your writing too, because, you know, you really talk about the nurture versus nature debate and how it's both. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah. There's a huge divide that exists. The nature versus nurture gap. And I feel that a lot of us who are interested in, gender and sexuality, especially with regards to activism around it, you know, whether we're feminists or whether we fall under the LGBTQ plus umbrella, a lot of times we need to challenge the way in which biology is overly, in an oversimplified way, presented to the public as, oh, well, it's all genes and chromosomes and hormones, and that's what makes men men and women women. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of problems with that gender essentialist or gender determinist point of view. And so a lot of times those of us on the activist side will challenge it by saying, no, it's all nurture, it's all socialization, and it's all gender and sexual norms. And there is some truth to that, but I think that a lot of times those extreme nurture arguments are just as problematic as the gender essentialist ones. Mm-hmm. And I will often point out that Sigmund Freud had a very socially constructed idea about, you know, that everything is nurture, yet he promoted a lot of very patriarchal and heterosexist ideology through that. Mm-hmm. So I think it's important to recognize that you can't separate biology from environment, from socialization. We are biological creatures, but we also live in a world where we're shaped by our social settings when we have experiences that shapes our brains. And so I think it's better to think of biology and biological variation and social norms and individual experience all coming together in a very complex way to create people who are all different from one another, and we each may express our genders or sexualities in particular ways that differ from other people, and that's just how it's going to be. And so instead of focusing all the attention on, you know, making the argument about nurture, I think it's important to talk about diversity, because biology is all about diversity.
Right. And I'm way out of my league here, but reading some of your work, I've been kind of wondering that possibly our diversity, gender diversity, and sexual diversity is part of the normal adaptive process that is, like, crucial for survival. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, the way that I think of it is that in regards to evolution, people talk about certain traits are very conserved versus being flexible.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, if there's something that the organism needs in order to survive, usually that system will be very conserved and won't change a lot from animal to animal. So, for example, how hearts function, the differences between our hearts and other mammal hearts, or even if you want to go to birds or whatever, I mean, there are some differences, but in general, there's a lot of conservation because that is a really crucial thing to have.
Mm-hmm.
In contrast, there's an overwhelming amount of evidence that aspects related to gender, sexuality, and biological sex are highly variable throughout the animal kingdom. Mm. Even if you look at primates, you know, just look at, you know, the differences between our two closest relatives. You have chimpanzees and bonobos, and basically kind of their sexual expressions are extremely different from one another. You know, chimpanzees kind of come across to us, we're interpreting them, we don't know actually what they're thinking, but chimpanzees come across as a lot more kind of patriarchal in their expressions of gender and sexuality, whereas bonobos are really, really flexible and sexually fluid, and yet there are two closest relatives. So I think that I try to think of it as aspects of gender and sexuality are intended to be flexible because there's not a really strong reason to have them extremely conserved. You know, there are lots of different ways that two different organisms can find one another and create to propagate the species. And
right.
So I'm not saying that nothing happens evolutionarily, but I think that we, growing up in our culture, that has a lot of assumptions about gender and sexuality, we tend to project our own views onto other animals or even human beings with regard to evolution more than I think is scientifically reasonable, if
yes.
that makes sense.
Yes. Oh, yes, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
It makes perfect sense. And we're, you know, when we have to depend on others, I think it makes absolute sense that we have the diversity, you know, so we can build various different kinds of structures and relationships. So, but that's very layman.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's 5 or 7 billion examples of humans in this world, and we're all kind of different, and sometimes even identical twins are a little different. So, you know, really like celebrate our diversity as a species and how we've survived this long. Let me go to the next question. We invited you, Julia, to talk about your work on the trans experience today. This question relates to our sexuality. Because the trend to misinterpret and not understand the term cis means to be based in part on not understanding between sexuality and gender. What is your viewpoint?
Sure. I think that there are a number of different misconceptions that exist with regards to cis terminology. And just to explain for people who might not be familiar with it, cis terminology is something that's been around in various manifestations over the last century. But sorry, go ahead.
Well, you just cut out for a second, but you're fine.
Okay. So, anyway, cis terminology has existed in different manifestations for many, many, many decades. In the last decade, it's gained popularity in use by particularly trans activists in order to kind of reframe debates about transgender people. It used to be that, you know, there were transgender people and we were the ones who were marked and seen as abnormal and unnatural, and everyone else was considered natural women and men, right? You know, they were thought of as biological men and genetic women. And I often joke that I'm a biologist and I can assure you that I'm not inorganic or non-biological in any way, right? And so the idea is that people in their minds already make a distinction between transgender people and so-called, you know, normal people. And that is, from that standpoint, it's really difficult to be a trans activist because you're always dealing with other people's assumptions that you're the problem. And so we, taking a page from many other activists, decided to purposefully name the dominant majority as cisgender. And the prefix cis exists. The prefix cis means on the same side, whereas trans means across. So there's, you could say that people who are cisgender identify with the gender that they were assigned at birth. Right. And it's important in the same way that, you know, since this is bi-cast, the obvious analogy to make would be it serves the same function as the term monosexual does in bisexual activism, in that there's an assumption that there's a dominant majority of people who are normal, and as long as that's the case, then people will make up all these theories and motives to explain why people are bisexual or to explain it away or to erase us. And so we say, no, actually, you're monosexual. And the problem, and both being, you know, bisexual or monosexual, they're both valid things to be. But the problem is we live in a world where people who are seen as bisexual are seen as less legitimate than people who are monosexual. So similarly, from my perspective, the only purpose that the word cisgender serves is to remind people that we live in a world where there's a double standard, that transgender people's gender identities and expressions are seen as less legitimate than cisgender people. And so it's a term that is important for activism. I think people come up with a lot of misconceptions about, you know, what cisgender means. I think sometimes, you know, the way the question was posed, I definitely think a lot of times people get confused about gender and sexuality, the difference between them. So a lot of times people who, you know, fall under the lesbian or gay or bisexual umbrellas, will sometimes assume that what trans people are has to do with sexuality and not gender, which is not how we experience ourselves. And so sometimes there's an assumption that when you've been, if I were to refer to someone as cisgender, that I'm making assumptions about their sexual histories or gender histories, and that is not true.
Yes, exactly. And it's very important that the difference is reinforced and recognized, because then we cannot move on and start making sense. I know a lot of people that get confused over sexuality and gender, and someone was recently called cis and was quite upset. No, I'm gay. And he was very upset that he thought he was being slandered.
Yeah, I do think it comes down to sometimes the way that we wield the terms, and you know, while we might put it in a very gentle context, people might have heard it used attached to a Molotov cocktail with a flame on it, and so that's where the conflict comes. Not from properly using terms, but from, you know, that kind of like battle. And I know we had the same problem with using the term monosexual. Oh, like in the last 5 years, that especially within the gay and lesbian community, people saw it as, insulting, or, that it was, you know, used to degrade their sexuality, or that, they were somehow wrong because they were monosexual. And, you know, that's why we always have to be careful.
Well, I mean, we have to be educators a lot. In your book, that you really specify that when you're talking about cis, you're referring to cisgender. And if you were talking about being successist, you actually will say the whole thing. And I think that's a good rule of thumb, to do that, to be, you know, more specific if you're talking about something else.
Yeah, I mean, I think that a lot of what we're touching on here is something that's just really common when you're dealing with communities that are marginalized. And a lot of times we have a lot of anger and frustration about the dominant majority group. Mm-hmm. And so in the way that, you know, there are times as someone who's a woman who moves through the world as a woman, there are sometimes that I have to deal with sexism from men, and or from, you know, straight people who would look down on me because I'm queer, because I'm bisexual. And there's a tendency to just want to be like, oh, straight people, oh, men, right?
Right.
And that is an understandable expression of frustration. I think mm-hmm. where it gets into problems is when we decide that every single person in the dominant majority is our enemy, or that they're all oppressing us. And once you start doing that, you're denying what is often called intersectionality, which is this idea that feminists of color forwarded, talking about how individual forms of marginalization all intersect with one another and exacerbate one another. And so when you talk about men, or you talk about straight people, you talk about cisgender people in as a whole, and you just completely dismiss them, you're ignoring the fact that a lot of people in those categories are also marginalized themselves. Mm-hmm. So I really try to avoid because I've had it done to me a lot. There are lots of, you know, feminists or gay and lesbian people who will, you know, dismiss me because I had male privilege, or that, you know, because I'm bisexual, that they see me as having straight privilege or straight passing privilege or whatever. And I feel like those kind of accusations are more of a problem when what we should be talking about is actual forms of sexism and marginalization, rather than just kind of wholly dismissing large categories of people.
Yeah, and I think that's really what happened in this case, because this was they really did feel like they were being attacked, and I really felt sorry for them, and we tried to help explain, but, you know, it was at the point where it was out of control, and, you know, there we lost a whole place for education, which is a shame, you know, so.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it is, you know, and you do a really good job in Excluded, especially the second half of the book, in which you really give us frameworks for how to do our work better and to really be responsible to each other, and mm-hmm. to really figure out ways in which we can better work together. And I think that's kind of where we're at as a problem again today. And, you know, I've been an activist for many decades, and I almost see it as a cyclical thing that mm-hmm. We work together at various points, and then we don't work together at other points, and we get so caught up in our own little world that we don't see the interconnectedness of all oppression together, and how we can all work together to, like, deal with it.
Well, you know, yeah. And we have new people coming all the time. People grow up, people come in to the community, people become interested. So it is an ongoing cycle all the time, I think.
Definitely.
So, in your opinion, what would you say is the most urgent concern for the trans community right now? What needs to be addressed right now?
Yeah, that's a good and complex question.
Yes.
I so I think the two things that, before I talk about any specific issues, the two things that I think need to be said the most are, one, I think any form of activism involves lots of people doing lots of things. Like, so I don't think that there's just, like, one trans issue that will solve everything. And so I think that, you know, whether some people are doing stuff to change, you know, the legal system or healthcare, or whether someone's just trying to change policies or the way bathrooms are arranged in their, like, local communities, I think that there are a lot of different things that are all important. And I think the second thing that needs to be said is, having said that, I think those of us who are kind of involved in activism really have to be aware of the fact that some people in our communities are way more marginalized than others. And a lot of times that's because they, in addition to experiencing, in this particular case, transphobia or sexism, in addition to that, they, a lot of these people are also facing, you know, misogyny if they're trans women, or they're facing racism or sexism, racism or classism or ableism on top of, you know, the whatever types of sexisms they're facing. And so I think it's really important that we pay attention to those in our community who are most marginalized, and recognize that, you know, there's a lot of work we can do with other communities in order to help, you know, trans people. So, for example, a lot of, I would say that for trans people, you know, kind of unemployment and economic issues, trans people are especially marginalized, potentially, I think, more so than most other people in the LGBTQ plus umbrella. And because of that, for example, a lot of trans people do sex work in order to survive. So I think that there's ways in which trans people can work with kind of sex worker activists to challenge that. Again, a lot of the people who are most marginalized in the community and those who face the most transphobic violence are trans people of color. And I think that working to end racism is really important. So those are, I think that all of that is really important. With regards to specific issues, I would say that basically trans people's access to healthcare, and I'm not even talking about, like, the means to transition. I'm just talking about a lot of times access to healthcare, or it comes if you're a trans person, even, you know, just going to a doctor can be a really marginalizing experience. I think that's important. I think allowing us to have our identities acknowledged by government institutions, by our workplaces, ending, you know, discrimination in all those spheres, I think is really important. So those are a few things. You know, the amount of, like I said, violence against trans people and homelessness, especially with regards to those in our community who are most marginalized, are extremely horrible problems that need to be addressed. And I don't know that there's one single cure all for it, but it's really important for us to focus there on those issues in addition to other things. So that's good. That was a very complicated, rambly answer to the question. I'm sorry.
It was actually perfect that all of the concerns are actually urgent.
going to say that. I just read an article a few days ago about going to the doctor with a broken arm while trans, and how doctors that, you know how to set a broken arm can't figure out how to set a broken arm from a person because they're trans, which has nothing to do with them being trans, except they have a broken arm. But I thought that was very interesting, and it really goes to the idea of just general healthcare for trans people. And, you know, we see this also in the bisexual community of how we get left out a lot in healthcare issues.
Yeah, definitely. And thanks for bringing that up, because, like, for example, I remember one time going to see a dermatologist for something that ended up being skin cancer. And, you know, one of the first questions that the doctor asked was, are you on any medications? And I said, yes. And so I said I was on estrogen. And he was like, oh, you know, what for? I'm like, well, because I'm transgender. And then it became like this 5-minute thing where he was all of a sudden like, oh, well, what direction? Like, it's like, I'm on estrogen, duh. But anyway, anyway, it became this big thing. And all of a sudden he's like questioning the fact I'm transgender. It's like, look, I'm a woman who's on estrogen, like a lot of women are, and I'm here because of this thing on my face. Okay. that's what this is about. But, and for me, that was all that was. For some people, I know people who doctors refuse to treat them for just things that had nothing to do with them being trans because of this idea, well, oh, well, you're trans and, you know, I might get into trouble if I, you know, there are just some people who just don't want to have to deal with trans people because of whatever kinds of stereotypes they have in their minds or that they just see us as being kind of not quite human. That is a very big problem.
Yeah, I another one I'll give you is trans men trying to get an OBGYN, and that's I've heard this multiple times, and you know it's like, duh, of course, and having trouble with insurance and having trouble like, you know, the OBGYN like scratching their head why they're coming in, and it's like, you know, it's an educational thing. And it's like, it's the kind of thing that you would figure that people would be able to see like something that easy, but no.
Yeah. And I think a lot of it is, I think sometimes if you're a part of a like minority marginalized group, whether it's you're transgender or bisexual, or queer or any other category, I think a lot of times once people know you're that, then they all of a sudden like treat you unlike they would treat anybody. It's like all of the information in their head just disappears. Yes. So for example, if you're bisexual, like if I tell people that I have a partner, you know, sometimes people will question, well, you're bisexual, then what about this and what about that? It's like, hey, I'm a person in a relationship with another person. Like, that's all you need to know, right? Exactly. But sometimes people are like, well, wait, but that's confusing because you're bisexual. And it's the same thing with being transgender. As soon as you tell people, not all people, some people are great. Some people, when you tell them you're transgender, they don't treat you any differently. But for some people, it's like all the information about human beings goes out the window. And all of a sudden they're like, you know, oh, well, you know, they ask you questions about like, you know, have you had surgery in your genitals? It's like, oh, we're allowed to talk about each other's genitals now?
Yeah.
You know, it's like, yeah, so.
Exactly.
This is Margaret Cho, and you're listening to The Bicast, podcasting for the bisexual community.
And John and I are back with Julia Serrano discussing her works and her books and her big, busy life. Welcome back.
Thanks.
Oh, okay, so I get to ask you about the New York Times op-ed by Eleanor Burkett from June 6th, and I read an awful lot about it after. I read commentary. I read like 10 pieces of commentary about it before I actually got to read the piece. So, you had a response on HuffPo. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, sure. I was grateful that they were interested in hearing my opinion on the issue. I had a lot of people asking me to like write something in response, and part of me was kind of like, actually my whole book Whipping Girl is kind of like a response to all those outdated feminist arguments against trans people. But then HuffPost contacted me and I got the chance to be on an interview, which is you can see online, it's still out there. So I was grateful to have that chance. And it was a very difficult thing to unpack because I think a lot of people who are kind of unaware about trans people and feminist debates about trans people probably looked at a lot of the things she said in her article and they probably made sense on the surface. But
yes.
In reality,
I will chime in and say, yeah, I had some older feminists who were promoting this op-ed, and they were some of the first people I really had to educate that day.
Sure, yeah. And a lot of those ideas make sense on the surface, and that's why they resonate with probably some readers and also with other feminists in the past. But if you actually are aware of basically the intersection of transgender activism and feminism, you'll realize that that basically it was kind of a kitchen sink argument, everything she could think of off the top of her head to dismiss trans people, mm-hmm. completely ignoring the fact that a lot of trans activists, most trans activists that I know, are feminists. And, mm-hmm. you know, just kind of using an offhand remark by Caitlyn Jenner when she's being kind of grilled in an interview for, like, mainstream TV and taking that one thing and, like, turning it into this idea that trans people are, like, undermining feminism is just kind of the it's not only bad feminism, it's stale bad feminism. It is yeah. the types of things that have been said for decades and have been disproven by the existence of a diverse trans community, many of us who are activists and challenging marginalization, not in addition to traditional sexism, all types of sexism, all types of marginalization.
Well, what the thing that disturbed me the most about this attempted propaganda really is what I heard, because you, by the language right away, it's like, oh my goodness, you know, some of her word choices. Is that someone who has no idea about the trans community or even feminism or the lesbian community or any community besides a hetero community, someone who's totally uninformed, is going to read this and it's going to sound like it makes sense. And that really concerned me when I saw it. It's like, oh, this isn't good.
Well, yeah, you know, I will say that one of the things that kind of I saw about Kate Jenner and the picture was that there were billions of words written about the picture before anybody even read the, what was it, a 22-page article in Vanity Fair. And so before even, you know, the cover of the magazine is to promote that 22-page story in Vanity Fair. And people didn't even get to that. They were talking about a picture. And I think some of that in this op-ed was also talking about a picture and picking out a couple of things that came out before the interview to pick on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, people who had problems kind of with the Vanity Fair cover, like there are two things. One is, and I heard this, I didn't have like the exact source to point to, but I heard that the reason why Caitlyn Jenner decided to pose in this very revealing way is because, not because she's a trans woman, but because she is a reality TV star who is transitioning, and she knew that the media and the paparazzi would hound her over and over again every single day she went out about what she was wearing and everything. And so supposedly she decided to do that, to like, just here, let's give the media everything. And then from this point forward, anything else I wear will kind of, you know, be no big deal in response. So for one thing, it was a very specific person who is a reality TV show making a choice, you know, that particular choice. Then the second thing is, when I go to the supermarket, there are magazine after magazine after magazine of cisgender women posing in all sorts of revealing ways. And we can, as feminists, talk about, you know, those depictions and the messages that they send and so on if we want to, but it would be horrible for me to just say cisgender women are propagating feminism, because look at them, they're all over all of those magazines, right? That would be a horrible argument to make. So why do it when a transgender woman does the same thing?
Yeah,
well,
why?
It goes into like that whole part in Excluded where you talk about the double bind, you're damned if you do it and you're damned if you don't. And you know, I think that's the I think Kate Jenner kind of has already kind of gone through a little bit of that.
Oh, definitely. I mean, she is, I don't know her personally. I don't know what's going on in her mind, in her actual day-to-day life. But, I mean, it was really, it's really hard for any person to transition. I can't imagine how difficult it is to transition while, like, navigating that, being under the scrutiny of not just being a trans person, but a trans person who is, like, the most famous trans person and who's a reality TV star, right? I can't imagine that. And honestly, you know, I hope that she does good for the trans community. I hope that that good comes from her transition and from her kind of being a very out trans person. But, you know, I wouldn't wish to have that kind of scrutiny placed on anybody. And, you know, to a certain extent, I hope she does good things, but no matter what she does, somebody somewhere is going to be critiquing her and dissecting her under a microscope.
Yes. Yes. You talk about your journey with psoriasis, skin cancer, and body image in your blog. I really love this piece. I'm also a psoriasis. I also have psoriasis. Mm-hmm. You also mentioned at some point how you could not separate your skin cancer from the trans viewpoint, which made it difficult to seek support. You know, another thing that adds to the isolation experienced by the trans community. Can we talk about that a little bit? I think it's important.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I'm happy to. Yeah, and so I should say, just for people who are out there, so the blog post that I talk about skin cancer and psoriasis most, it's called Skin. So you could Google my name and the word skin, and it will probably show up. And then the chapter in Excluded where I talk about skin cancer is called Margins.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I mean, I think there are two different things. So for one, you know, when I had skin cancer, and basically it was, I sort of alluded to it earlier, it was on my face. I lost a decent chunk of my face, and then had a couple plastic surgeries to kind of, fix up the hole. And it was really difficult for me as a trans person. A lot of times if you're a trans person, people are always trying to scan you, looking for, you know, basically the way you transformed yourself, kind of in the way that people keep talking about Caitlyn Jenner's transformation. Like, people assume that you've had all these surgeries and all this work done. And so for me personally, I mean, a lot of people have plastic surgery, and a lot of people have surgery in response to kind of medical conditions. You know, so in this case, I was repairing a hole that was in the middle of my face. Yeah, it was kind of hard, especially I have a decent scar. Some people say it's not noticeable. Some people do notice it. But it's hard. It was hard for me as a trans person kind of having that experience. I really wanted to talk about it, but I felt like there is, like, locally, there is kind of a women's cancer survivor organization, at least there was then, that they had support groups and everything. And I thought about going, but it's like, if I go there, it's to this women's support group as a trans woman, knowing what, like, for example, we were just talking about that New York Times editorial and what some women automatically think when they think of trans women. It was like, I knew that I couldn't really talk about my skin cancer without also talking about being trans, and that it just wouldn't, most cancer support groups wouldn't be safe spaces for me to talk about the intersection of those two things in my life. So that was the one way in which kind of those issues relate in my life. And then another one, which I kind of talk about in Excluded a bit, is talking about, I tend to see parallels. I think that different situations are different for different people. I think, you know, being transgender and being bisexual are very different things, but sometimes the way that people treat you, like we're talking about people kind of ignoring everything they understand about human beings when you're seen as different in some way, I tend to look for parallels. And so for me, I found a lot of parallels in my life, both in the way in which people reacted at the time when I was dealing with cancer, and also, you know, as someone who has psoriasis, kind of the way in which other people react to that, or kind mm-hmm. of the presumption that that's information that you have to manage. Like, the assumption mm-hmm. is you don't have psoriasis, and so, say, you're dating someone, or say, you know, you have a flare-up, and it's it's very noticeable. All of a sudden people are commenting upon it, or they think it's okay to make assumptions about you because of it. And so I definitely saw like lots of parallels there. You know, very, all three of these things are very different from one another, but I definitely saw a lot of parallels, and I think a lot of it is about being someone who's kind of marked in the eyes of society. And I talk about this a lot in Excluded, and the assumptions that when you're someone who's marked, that people can comment about you and question your existence or your motives, or you know, the way that they like exoticize people or see people as fascinating or interesting because of this way in which they're different from others. And so those are some of the ideas that I've kind of grappled with over the years.
Yeah, yeah. I would say, but that's one of the things I found really great about the way that you write and it, both of your books. I mean, you're basically talking about you, the specific person, but there's a lot of universality in what you're saying. It applies not just across sexuality and gender, but it applies across everywhere, right? And how we're perceived. And I think you do a great job in taking your personal story and really being able to make it a universal story. People should be able to read it that way.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Thank you for that. Yeah, I mean, I think about that a lot. I mean, I feel that there are lots of different types of activism, and I've engaged in very angry and confrontational forms of activism at points in my life. And sometimes being provocative in that way can be useful or mobilizing. I tend to more err on I think it's useful as an activist to try to encourage people to understand where you're coming from and see parallels between your experience and theirs. And again, I think it's really important to stress, you know, I'm not doing this to assume that, oh, well, you know, all of us are doing the same thing. Being transgender is the same as being bisexual, which is the same as this, which is the same as that. Not at all. But I do think that noticing parallels is really useful. Like I remember when talking about me being trans with a friend of mine, and she was a very tall cisgender woman. And it became really clear that we had a lot in common. She is someone who every time she walks into a room, like, she will be noticed and people will comment on her being really tall. Wow, you're really tall for a woman. And, you know, she's not marginalized in the same way that transgender people are, but as soon as we start talking, she could relate a bit. And I think it's important for us to relate to one another in seeing ourselves as human beings and seeing where we have commonality, as opposed to like people presuming that, oh, well, I understand being transgender because I'm tall, right? You know, so I think that there's a way to do this in a way that's productive rather than a way that kind of erases another group.
Very good. Is there anything else you'd like to add today?
Oh, I've got one more question.
Oh, do you?
Yeah,
oh, you
because,
do?
Yeah, I do.
I just jumped right out of there.
Okay, it's fine. So you're also a rock star. Can you talk a little bit about your music projects?
Sure, yeah. Rock star is I'll take it, but that might be a bit overstated. Yeah, my music was my first creative outlet since I was, like, in high school, and it's something that I've done to varying degrees over the years. For a while, I was in a band called Bite Size, and we can still be found on the internet, bitesize.net, and there's lots of free MP3s that you can listen to. And we were kind of like a noise pop band or indie rock band, and I played guitar and sang. And so we did that for many years. Our music is kind of quirky, sometimes humorous. And then I took a lot of time off from music because I had a day job and there wasn't enough time to write and do activism and do music. But in the last year or two, I've had more time and I've started to do a new solo music project that's called Soft Vowel Sounds, and which can be found at softvowelsounds.com. And again, there's music there. And so right now I just have a little 4 EP that's released, which includes my parody song of the famous Kink song Lola. So feel free to check that out. And yeah, so right now that's just like a little solo music project, and I'm working on some new songs. So it's definitely music takes a bit of a backseat compared to, like, my writing, which is kind of my main focus these days. But it's still something that I enjoy.
Ray. Yes, I really enjoyed both Ray and Music Box. They're quite good.
Yay.
A lot of fun. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, now I will try. Is there anything else you'd like to add today?
We've talked about my books, which, I'm still promoting. I'm kind of working on the next thing, which I'm not kind of ready to talk about yet, but it'll be a collection of a lot of my trans-themed writings over the last decade. So in the future, people might want to keep their eye out for that. But right now, that's, we talked about the music and the books, so that's a lot of what I've been doing.
Yeah, I know that you've been taking on Bailey a little bit these days, and we always love it when Dr. Bailey gets beaten up.
Yeah.
Actually, that is something that is very, very recent. In fact, my blog post just went up today on that. I didn't know if I wanted to open up the autogynephilia J. Michael Bailey can of worms.
We got him a couple years after his book because, 2005 was the big New York Times article, Gay, Straight, or Lying, which he was a big part of. And so we had to deal with him. And it was good that he had written that horrible book because it was a little easier to demonize him.
Yeah. he does a good job of demonizing himself. Like, I mean, every time people that when I'm talking to them and they have no idea who he is, I'm like, well, he believes this and he believes that and he believes this and he believes that. And, even like feminist friends of mine who aren't really aware of kind of his writings about trans women or bisexual folks, a lot of times I'll just like quote parts of his book because a lot of his book is so sexualizing. It's so sexist, his assumptions about, women and men, that people are just like, oh, my God.
And the other thing is he's been in the news in the last year. I guess he's going to the Gap looking for gay jeans. We go back to the nurture. We go back to the nurture-nature part and the nature part. And just in this last year when this research that he had done, well, the stuff that he'd done that they call research about finding the gay gene, I actually went back to some gay writers and talked to them a little bit. And it wasn't until I told them, and proved that he's looking for the gay gene in order to abort fetuses. So it's like his plan for genocide. And then they really started to get that. He's not a good person.
Not a good guy.
Yeah, he markets himself very well, though. Like, it's impressive to see, like, how he just shows up. Like, there'll be some article about trans people, and he'll just show up in it. It's just like, who's recommending him? Like, I know of people who have, let's say, kind of medical or psychological views of trans people that I disagree with, but like even them, like I think they see Bailey as he's basically like the Donald Trump of sexologists, right? even people who kind of agree with him are horrified about the way he puts it.
Oh my god, yes,
we need another candidate for the crazy anti-trans person because J. Michael Bailey doesn't do it for us, right? But he said, yeah, it is. He's, if you just, maybe we should do a website of quotes of J. Michael Bailey so that anytime he gets in the news, we can just send a link.
Yeah, we should have the press releases ready to go. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. You can find – I already did that. You can find out more about Joya Serrano and our previous guests by visiting our website, www.thebycast.org, where you will find all the links to the topics discussed today. I want to remind everyone, you are not wrong, you're not broken, and you are not alone. You are just a human, and you are bisexual.
Bye.
Bye. The views expressed on the Bicast do not necessarily represent those of Bi-Net USA or the Bicast crew.
Look at that.